UK Wine Show, show number 205. James Leonard's on wines versus teeth, protection, prevention and cure. Hello and welcome to this week's UK Wine Show. Whether you worry about your molars, your canines or your incisors, this show should see you smiling with a bright white smile. We're going to be talking with dentist James Leonard. Now, James is a dentist from Marlborough, and he's been working with a lot of winemakers on how to improve their teeth. Teeth and wine are not a great combination, and we find out about how to keep those gnashes shining and tip-top shape. This show's going out quite late on Sunday. Well, I'm writing it and recording it on Sunday anyway. It's been quite a busy period for me. We've been doing a lot of reorganization in our business, and I've had my goddaughter over from Ireland. So if you've been looking forward to picking up the show on Monday morning, sorry for the delay. On the positive side, though, this weekend I've had my second barbecue. This makes us 100% up on last year, which was supposed to be a barbecue summer, so it's all looking good at this stage. Let's not talk about barbecues, let's crack on with this week's show. And this week we're going to be looking at wine glasses in the spotlight again, and the mystery producer slash person is coming up first, though. Let's give you the first clue. Now, as usual, I'm going to give you a clue now, and then I'm going to give you another clue after the news and just before the interview, and then I'll give you the answer at the end of the show. So, our mystery producer is from California, and his winery, which he set up, is now owned by Constellation Brands, which are a huge producer of wine. It was founded originally, though, in 1966 by its namesake. The man himself was a tireless ambassador who helped transform the wine culture in America. He was also constructive in helping to introduce European winemaking techniques into the US, such as using French barrels for oak aging and stainless steel tanks for fermentation. He's also popularized Fumé Blanc, the name which is coined by dry fermentation oak age Sauvignon Blanc way back in the 1960s. The release of his Cabernet Sauvignon in the late 1960s signaled the potential of Napa winemaking. Now I'm going to give you the other clues after the news, which is coming up next with Jane.
Thanks, Chris. Several wine merchants in the USA expect prices for the 2009 Bordeaux vintage to be high, following the hype surrounding the vintage so far. According to Californian merchant John Fox, there's a definite feeling in the trade that the vintage will be in demand and that first growths will be snapped up at any price. Others in the trade agree, but warned caution given the economic climate in 2010 compared to 2006, when prices rocketed for the now legendary 2005 vintage. Meanwhile, fine wine merchant Bordeaux Index alleges that unscrupulous traders in Shanghai had hoodwinked private customers into ordering and paying for the 2009 vintage of top Bordeaux wines before the prices had actually been released. Simon Staples, sales director at Berry Brothers & Rudd in London, said caution was necessary in a market that has not traditionally bought en primeur. He said the next few months could easily be used, wittingly or unwittingly, by wine shops all over the world to sell bogus stock.
Robert Parker announced his view on the 2009 vintage, describing the wines as not far off the quality of 2005 and 2000. His high praise indicates that once bottled, the wines, in his words, may turn out to be the finest vintage he'd ever tasted in 32 years of covering Bordeaux. He also claims this could be the vintage that Asia enters the on-premier market. Whether the wine merchants in Asia are willing to take up the mantle of the American buyers, who haven't been as enthusiastic after being burnt with an expensive and lower quality vintages since the 2006, which were driven up in price by the incredibly priced 2005 vintage. But in America, Diageos, Chateaus and Estates exited their Bordeaux market, selling off wines at a discount of 40 to 60% only 3 months ago in the US. And as a result, American buyers such as Gary Vaynerchuk have said publicly that they're keeping clear of the 2009. It may be a great vintage, but if Asia doesn't enter the on-premier market to snap it up, it may not be as great as people think. What is certain is that the UK market is interested, and they're quite happy to sell their wines to Asia in a few years' time, especially when you consider the likes of Berry Brothers and Rudd, who've opened up another store in Hong Kong this week. So this may be the route to the freewheeling Asian investor through UK purchases of on-premier. What's the next story, Jane?
Well, on a completely different tack, traditionally we think of the five senses as separate and independent from one another, but new research suggests our hearing could enhance our sense of smell. This discovery of a new sight smell sound, or smound, happened accidentally during an experiment on mice to find out how the olfactory tubercle responds to odours. In further investigations, when odours were accompanied by a sound, 29% of the time the responses were either enhanced or suppressed, depending on the presence or absence of the second stimulus. Scientists Daniel Weston and Donald Wilson are planning to develop useful technology relating to the findings, for example, a device emitting sound that could increase a dog's sensitivity to explosives. But wine lovers could just have fun listening to different types of music while sipping their favourite wine to see if it improves the flavour.
This sounds, pardon the pun, very similar to a concept known as synesthesia, where one sensory pathway leads to an involuntary experience in a secondary cognitive pathway. The one I'm most familiar with, although I haven't suffered from it, is called colour graphemic synesthesia. Sounds very complicated, but these are where letters or numbers are perceived as having an inherent colour. Another type is ordinal linguistic personification synesthesia, where numbers, days, weeks, months, or even years develop its own personality. I think most of you may have experienced this, the drag of Monday morning, the relief of Friday, although I think it's a bit more than that. Anyway, it's great to see research in that direction. But to know if you suffer from it, does the pop of a Merit or a champagne make you salivate? Perhaps this is the type of synesthesia.
Okay, last up this week, a grape-eating moth is threatening crops in the Napa Valley wine region in California and has prompted the California Department of Food and Agriculture to impose a quarantine regulating the shipment of fruit and some plants. The European grapevine moth was first detected in Oakville last September, and traps set across the region have confirmed the moth is spreading. The moth's larvae do the most damage, emerging in the spring to eat young clusters of grapes or flowers. Then second and third generation moths eat the ripening grapes. That's it from me this week, but don't forget to check out our website 3050.co.uk.
Cheers, Jane. Okay, let's jump into this week's spotlight. I did say last week I was going to do a book review, What Price Bordeaux, but sadly I haven't managed to finish reading it. Sorry about that. I will get to it, not next week because we've got our poll result, but the week after that. So stay tuned for that. But this week we're going to finish off that look at wine glasses, and we're going to be looking at champagne glasses in particular. Now, champagne glasses have been around for a while, and over the years there's been quite a few different types of glasses to drink from. The three key shapes are the coupe, the champagne coupe, the flute, and the tulip, which is basically a normal wine glass. The flute is the oldest shape, dating back to Roman times, although there wasn't any fizzy wine back then. And the oldest shape designed specifically for champagne was the champagne coupe. Now, it was invented in 1666 by a Venetian glassmaker working for the Duke of Buckingham in his glass factory in Greenwich, England. Although a lot of French people attribute it to being the shape of Marie Antoinette's breast, which is incorrect because she wasn't really around until about 100 years later. Given it was an English person anyway, if it was based on Marie Antoinette's breast, it should be based on an English Marie Antoinette, and since we all like champagne, I think we should call it the Jordan glass. Anyway, the coupe lost favour in the middle of the 20th century to the flute, which tended to keep the wine fizzier for longer. The coupe's large surface area exposed to air means that the champagne quickly becomes flat. Aesthetically, the flute is also more elegant, with bubbles rising gracefully to the top. Japanese scientists have also shown that as the bubble rises and lingers longer in the fizz, it actually picks up more flavours, depositing this above the wine, giving it a better nose. Also, the flute with its long length and narrow opening tends to shoot the wine to the back of the mouth, which we discussed earlier, which is either rightly or wrongly good in terms of minimising the acidity of the wine. And let's face it, champagne is acidic. The last thing flutes have got is that they don't tend to spill. If you have a champagne coupe, you can imagine getting knocked and the wine will go everywhere. With a flute, you get knocked, you're going to lose a lot less fizz, which is always very important. And so a lot of people say, well, which is better, the coupe or the flute? The thing is, most champagne experts and houses will actually go for a normal wine glass. In fact, an ISO tasting glass is quite a good shape for a champagne. It's got a reasonably narrow open, so it doesn't let the champagne go too flat, especially if you fill it up a bit more than just at the wine 50ml bit at the bottom. And the aromas are concentrated at the top, which is really nice. You can get your nose in there and give it a bit of a swirl and a sniff. So it's quite a nice glass. And a lot of people think that is the preferred shape. Obviously, the champagne flute is a gorgeous-looking glass. So for my money, I would probably tend to go for the flute. But the classic white wine glass is not a bad shape. Well, let's move on after the flutes. You can probably tell I'm a bit blocked up. I'm not feeling too well. So let's move on. And then we're going to give you the second clue in our mystery producer slash personality. And the mystery producer's company expanded in 1979 by buying Woodbridge Winery in Lodi, California. And it also formed a partnership with French winery Baron Philippe de Rothschild to create Opus One, a premium Cabernet Sauvignon-based red wine. Some pretty big clues there if you know the person. And also, our mystery man believed that a more gracious lifestyle could be achieved through an appreciation of wine, food and art, and has dedicated much time and effort in promoting this ideal, culminating in a $25 million donation in 2001 by him and his wife Margaret to establish an Institute of Wine and Services at the University of California, Davis. Today, the winery that bears his name exports to 80 countries around the world, and wine is made from a range of grape varieties, from Chardonnay, Pinot Grigio, Moscato, to Pinot Noir, Merlot, Cabernet Sauvignon, Zinfandel, and even Shiraz. That's the last clue. Hopefully you've worked out who it is. He's not particularly difficult to work out. I'll give you the answer after our interview, which is coming up next, and we're talking with James Leonard on wine versus teeth, protection, prevention, and cure. Let's have a listen to what he has to say.
Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and I'm here with James Leonard. You're a dentist, aren't you, James?
Yep, that's right, Chris.
Excellent. And we're in Marlborough region at the moment, so I suppose you get to see a lot of winemakers' teeth.
Yeah, absolutely, Chris. I've had my practice here in Blenheim for the last 5 years, and I've been seeing a lot of winemakers in that time with a whole lot of different experience in the industry, so it's been really great.
Are they got good teeth, bad teeth? You know, I look around the wine trade in the UK and I see teeth that looks very much like Austin Powers.
I can see it. I think poor Austin Powers has given poor old men from the UK a bit of a bad name in that respect. Yeah. Chris. But no, look, I would say in general, actually, winemakers tend to have good teeth because they tend to take an interest in them and care for them.
Yep.
Reasonably switched on people as a general rule, I guess.
Yeah. And what I want to do today is just talk a wee bit about what the problems are with your teeth and wine, and also things that you can do to protect your teeth. And there's a couple of weird things that people always ask me about, like, you know, teeth staining and things like that. But let's try and understand a wee bit about wine and teeth to start off with.
Sure.
Wine's got acidity and sugar, so it's not the best combination. But what's the biggest problem with your teeth? Which is it the sugar that's the worst, or is it the acidity, or is there tannins? What are the problems?
Sure, Chris. In terms of straight damage to the tooth, I think it's very much the acidity.
It is.
The low pH that's the problem. And what we're dealing with is a specific problem for winemakers or drinkers and tasters of a lot of wine is a straight sort of a acid versus mineral attack.
Yeah. Mineral, like in the calcium?
Absolutely. I mean, the surface of the teeth that we're consuming with, what you see in everyone's mouth, is largely enamel. In fact, almost entirely enamel. And that's the hardest, most mineralized tissue in the body. It's about 96% mineral, with just that little remaining 4% being sort of a protein matrix that the mineral sits in. So whilst it's very hard and tough, even compared to something like the bones of the body,
yep.
It's definitely susceptible to an attack from acid.
So some wines worse than others?
Yeah, I think so, Chris. I mean, yeah, you and your audience will probably answer this question better than me. But basically, the lower the pH, you know, or the higher the acidity of anything, the more dangerous it is. And I think the other really important factor is the length and the frequency of exposure.
Just on pH, is it purely pH? Because in wines, there's a couple of different types of acidity. There's tartaric acid, there's malo acid, there's lactic acid. Is it just pH, or are different acidities a problem?
I think, Chris, that it's the overall effect of we have those different types of acid, but I think it's the sum total pH, if you like, of everything that's involved that's the really critical issue.
I suppose that for the quaffers who just the wine barely touches the side and goes straight down, they're actually pretty good. But we've been trained to get the wine in your mouth, swish it around, think about the flavours, and then swallow. So probably tasting wine well is the worst thing.
I think you're absolutely right. I think people that they say just quaff it and knock it back aren't getting that length of exposure. And I think the other thing that that you and your audience need to be aware of is that you're having a huge exposure when you go to a large tasting, or for people who are winemakers during the winemaking process, they're exposing their teeth many, many, many times the amount of wine and the length of contact of wine when they're tasting properly than your average drinker who just sits down and has it with a meal.
So how does normal tooth decay work then if we're worried about the acidity in the wine? I've always been thought sugar is a problem.
Absolutely, Chris, and you're quite right. So normal tooth decay that I'm getting fillings in between our teeth from is caused by naturally occurring bacteria in the mouth feeding on sugar that's present in our mouth from diet and converting it to acid as a product of their own metabolism. And that acid is what's actually making the holes between the teeth. The difference between the normal tooth decay and the effects we see from wine and wine making and doing a lot of wine tasting is that normal tooth decay predominantly occurs in harder to get to areas, for example, in between teeth and in the pits and fissures of the teeth. And it's only in somebody with an extreme oral hygiene and decay problem that you would see normal tooth decay appearing on flat, smooth front surfaces of upper teeth. Okay, yeah. Which is, by contrast, where you tend to get the majority of your damage from the straight acid attack from wine.
So drinking dessert wine isn't really a problem compared to the acidity damage that we're going to get, because the sugar just converts to acidity later on, but we're taking loads of acidity in straight away.
Absolutely, and straight on those front teeth. And it's been interesting. This is just purely anecdotal observations from my own practice, but I generally don't find that that winemakers seem to have a problem with normal tooth decay around the rest of their mouth, whether it's because you're a conscientious bunch or not, I don't know, but they certainly don't seem to have an above average problem from the sugar as such. It's just the front teeth getting hammered with the acid that seems to be the issue.
So what's happening to the teeth? The acidity's getting in there and doing what?
Absolutely. So the acidity is getting in there and basically demineralizing the surface. The acid is attacking and pulling mineral out of the surface of the tooth and just effectively slowly eroding it away. Reminds me of when I was over in your part of the world seeing the very old castles that have been exposed to acid rain, and you go up on the battlements and you see they're all pitted. So, it's a very... in general, a very gradual process, but over a period of time, it can remove a significant amount of the tooth surface.
Does the tooth surface continually grow, or what's a teeth? If I'm losing a bit of a minerality, is that a problem in the long run because my teeth are constantly growing and replacing it, or do they stop growing? What's the story there?
Yeah, that's a really good question, Chris. The teeth are not growing. As such, like for example, something like the skin that's constantly replacing itself from the inside out, if you like. But what can happen and can be quite significant is there can be a degree of remineralization that can occur to the surface at other times, and that's certainly something that's important for people who are having this acid exposure or acid erosion, if you like, from wine. So it's more that it. I guess there's two factors. Firstly, the teeth can be rebuilt from the outside, and also the quality of the surface of the teeth can be to a degree increased as well to be more acid resistant, if you like.
Okay, is that so? Okay, so you're putting a protective layer in front, or you can just build the walls up again?
Absolutely. I mean, both, Chris. I guess...
is that a naturally occurring thing?
It is. I mean, there's a lot of variation between winemakers and serious wine tasters, wine judges, in how much their teeth are affected. It's been quite interesting looking at a sort of a fairly broad selection of people in the wine industry in Marlborough, New Zealand, over the past 5 years, in that I have some people who have been making, you know, Sauvignon Blanc here in Blenheim for 30 years, and in fact some of them perhaps don't have the best oral hygiene in other respects. But,
do you name any names?
Having said that, you know, have very little in terms of acid erosion or acid effect on their teeth, whereas I have had people come in after their very sort of first ever vintage, you know, and season as a winemaker, already showing really obvious signs of acid effect on the teeth. And when I say obvious signs, you know, they often come in with symptoms like sensitive or sore teeth or surfaces that feel a bit rough or perhaps a staining more than usual. And when I dry the teeth with the air, which I know is something most people hate the dentist doing, blast of compressed air on the teeth, but the surface actually looks less glossy, you know, almost a bit sort of chalky or matte. Okay, yeah. And I think the reason for those there are a couple of reasons for that variation between, you know, different individuals, and just like anything else in the body, I think there's a difference in the makeup of the tooth surface. So, you know, whilst I've already said teeth are, you know, highly mineralized and very hard, some people's teeth, the surface makeup of the enamel is more resistant, okay, to the acid attack. Mm-hmm. But I think a really significant factor for people in the wine industry is the acid buffering ability of the saliva.
Oh, okay.
That's a really important thing.
So if you salivate a lot, you're gonna decrease the intensity of the acidity?
Absolutely. I mean, there's two things with the saliva. One, as you just said, is the quantity of the saliva, the salivary flow, and I think another really important thing is the actual acid buffering ability of the saliva, which does vary from person to person.
Does that raise the pH?
Absolutely. Okay. Yeah. So bring it back to a more neutral sort of situation.
Oh, okay. Okay, but I suppose some wines make you salivate a lot more. Normally it's the higher acid wines that make you salivate.
Sure. Yeah, sure, absolutely. And you know, we all sit at a dinner party and have you know, have something to drink that is really high acid, and you get that thing. I guess that's part of the experience, you know, it's quite enjoyable. But again, the thing is, for people in your field and your listeners, they're enjoying or tasting so many wines, they're constantly washing that saliva away and resupplying the acid in the mouth.
Do the teeth remineralize? Is that the right word?
That's right, yeah, absolutely.
How do they remineralize? Because if they're not growing from the inside out, how do you get the minerals back on there?
Sure, and two major sources, you know, sources from the body, which is really just in the saliva, mm-hmm. and calcium and phosphate ions, things going back into the surface from the body secreting in the saliva, and then there's the external stuff you put on. So fluoride, you know, dentist's best friend is a really big one. Okay,
fluoride, so that actually builds the teeth back up.
It does. In a basic sense, Chris, what happens is it can be incorporated into the surface of the enamel, and it actually makes that surface stronger, harder, more acid resistant.
So should someone be drinking water with fluoride water with their wine? So, you know, a bit of water, a bit of wine, or is that just a bit crazy?
I hadn't considered having fluoride in the water during tastings, Chris. Certainly, I think, I mean, if we look at perhaps briefly what, you know, when you guys are doing a big flight of wines or a lot of tastings, I think that, you know, that rinsing with water is something that's quite valid. Mm-hmm. Okay, obviously, I'd imagine that I haven't been to any large-scale wine tastings myself, but I imagine there are several points during the day where there are natural pauses between, say, varieties or sessions, flights, yeah. I guess you guys call them, with tastings, and you know, rinsing with water is very valid. Another thing that I think I've been advising people that I think can be quite useful is actually chewing a sugar-free chewing gum.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and the reason for that being, I don't know if you have them in the UK, but here in New Zealand we have these ads saying stimulate saliva flow after meals and things like that, and it really does work, you know, provided you can find something that you're happy isn't going to interfere with your taste buds. Mm-hmm. Between then and the next flight, just chewing a piece of gum, stimulating that saliva flow, you know, that's going to be a useful thing during a day's tasting.
Yeah, I think most chewing gum's got flavour, and, you know, have you ever seen the movie Sideways where the guy's tasting these nice wines and he's going, are you chewing gum?
Absolutely.
It's not the done thing in the wine trade.
No, no. And I can say, I mean...
What about, like, building up a lot of saliva in your mouth? Because I can just, you know, get a bit of saliva in there and just rinse it around my teeth. Would that help?
Sure. Absolutely, Chris. That's going to be far more benefit than doing them.
Especially if I've got some nice wines lined up beforehand, like Pavlov's dog, start salivating at the idea of getting into them.
your learned response. Nice wine coming up, time for saliva.
All right, so some sort of saliva, or one way of getting saliva into your mouth. Is there anything you can drink that's maybe a replacement for saliva? Is there like a saline solution? Or because chewing gum really isn't going to work for me anyway, tasting wine.
Sure. No, I understand what you're saying with the, because I think, you know, in that case, rinsing with water is good. Some people have suggested to me that they even find milk beneficial, because milk is something that has an alkali pH, you know, so that's going to be buffering the acid.
Oh, so milk's not acidic at all?
No.
Oh, so it's alkalized, and alkalized like the opposite of acidity, so it neutralizes it.
Absolutely. I mean, that's like,
and there's calcium in milk as well.
Absolutely. So it's got to be good for you.
Yeah.
Another thing that several studies have shown to be beneficial is actually eating cheese.
Cheese and wine. Enough. Oh, that's now. Yeah, cheese and wines isn't a bad thing.
No, perhaps that's something we can work with a bit more here.
Yeah.
So, you know, cheese, you know, again, has a higher pH, so it's going to help to neutralise the acidity and hang about in your mouth a bit longer. And that is something that people have shown to be of some use.
Okay, so milk, cheese. Maybe not chewing gum.
No, sure. unless you can find something fairly mild that's not going to hang around and, you know, and bother your taste buds.
Okay, and water, rinsing quite regularly with water. Not every wine, you could just do a flight and then have a bit of a rinse and a rest. Or
Look, absolutely. There are several other important strategies. Without overstating it, you guys really are capable of giving your teeth a good hammering with acid,
yeah,
like nothing else. When you have these you know, full days tastings, or even several days in a row, let alone the winemaking process itself. And there are things that can be done leading up to those heavy acid sessions, if you like, to help protect the teeth. And obviously, we touched on the fluoride.
Yeah.
It's a good one, and we should all really be
is
using that.
Toothbrush or water, just normal tap water that's been fluoride?
Oh, sorry, yeah, I mean, in the toothpaste. Everyone should really be using fluoridated toothpaste anyway. Some studies have shown that there can be a benefit to using a fluoridated mouthwash leading up to, you know, intense wine tasting sessions.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously that evening and afterwards. And there are also some really good products coming onto the market over the last 5 years that contain active calcium and phosphate that are designed for really highly mineralizing the tooth surface and protecting them afterwards. Yeah, and at this stage, in New Zealand, they're available through pharmacies and through dentists.
Yep.
And they come in the forms of topical paste you can apply at night, and also sticks of gum that you can chew. But they've been something fairly new on the scene that seems to be really helpful.
So sticks of gum. So on the way out of the tasting, you pop a bit of chewing gum in your mouth and you just chew that on the way home or something.
Absolutely.
Like that.
And
are these special gums?
Absolutely, Chris. I mean, any gums can be beneficial because it'll be stimulating the saliva flow, but these gums load the mouth with mineral ions that you can get back into that tooth surface. And another important thing that people here seem to have been really good at cottoning onto is not brushing the teeth immediately after coming from a heavy day's wine tasting. And I can imagine the temptations there. You've been we've been outside eating cheese and drinking wine all day, and you've got to go out for a, you know, for a nice dinner in the evening.
Yeah.
Really tempting to go home and brush the teeth straight away.
Yeah, for sure.
But that's actually something that is potentially a bit dangerous.
Why is that? Is it the teeth soften up or something?
Absolutely, Chris. So you've had this acid attack. The surface of the teeth is a bit more porous, a bit technically a bit softer, if you like. And if you go and put some abrasive toothpaste on there and have a good scrub with a toothbrush, you can really speed up the stripping away of that surface.
All right, but that's quite a problem. Some people I've seen, you know, they come back from a session tasting wine and their teeth are just black. Some people drink the same wines with them and their teeth are fine. What's going on there?
Is it so that I've heard this referred to as the Dracula look? Is this after red wine?
Yeah.
Yeah. Now that's an interesting one that a lot of patients ask me about. And I think there are two things with the red wine. One is a long-term thing, the same sort of thing that you get from a lot of foods, drinking coffee, smoking cigarettes, you know, and that's the gradual long-term discoloration of the teeth.
Yep.
You get the smile goes a bit darker, and that's something that can be dealt with dental tooth whitening.
They just bleach it, don't you?
Absolutely.
Because it soaks into the tooth.
Yeah, absolutely. You're quite right. But what I think you're referring to is that more acute short-term...
You know, red wine.
Red wine, look of blackness, perhaps for a few hours or for some people.
And it's not a good look, so you want to get home and shine up the gnashes straight away.
Absolutely. And what that is, that immediate Dracula look that people refer to, is actually just a build-up of coloured pigments from the wine in a layer of surface proteins and saliva just on the surface of the teeth. So for the majority of people, it will just scrub off. But as we've just said, that's not a good thing to do. Reading a report from one woman, she said she just gets it to a much worse effect than a lot of her winemaking friends. And she said she simply goes somewhere discreet, takes a serviette or a napkin and wipes off the best of it and cleans the rest off later once her teeth have had a bit of a rest. But
so you can rub it off?
And in the majority of cases, you can.
And the serviette won't do too much damage?
Well, nothing like giving the teeth a good scrub with a toothbrush, no.
Yeah, okay. But what's going on? It's just, why are some people more susceptible than others to it? Is it the pitting on the teeth, or
I think again, Chris, it's a it's mainly due to a difference in the saliva.
Saliva.
Yeah, I think some people's saliva is stickier, is holding that pigment a lot, you know, holding it onto the surface of the teeth. Obviously, if the tooth surfaces are a bit rougher, they're going to to help hold it there for longer. But I think it's mainly the quality of the saliva that's having the effect.
Okay, so your saliva's a bit sticky, so you don't want to kiss anybody who's got sticky red teeth, because then swap a bit of saliva. The last
thing. Yeah, you think it might be contagious.
Yeah. Come on, you come away with red teeth afterwards yourself. That's not a good thing, is it?
Perhaps we need to do a study of some winemaking
families. Not you and me. No, we're fine. Oh, some winemaking families. Yeah, no, that would work.
Yeah, that would work. Yeah, see if it's something that's passed down through the generations.
Okay, so... all you can really do if you are a Dracula, so to speak, just wipe your teeth with a serviette, don't brush them, and then just bad luck you have. How long should you wait after a wine tasting before you can brush your teeth safely?
Now, that's a good question, Chris, and the current wisdom on that is an hour.
An hour's not too bad.
No, I mean, an hour is passable. You know, give you time. You can just go and drive around the block in your car before you go and pick your girlfriend up or something like that. You know, it's not too bad.
Is it like one of those things where, you know, it's a, you know, the very first half hour is the worst, and then the next half hour is not so bad, and then if you waited another hour, it wouldn't really make too much difference?
I think because the longer the better, but I think you're quite right. I think as time goes by, the benefit is going to decrease, because what's happening over that hour of waiting is that surface that's been slightly softened and attacked by the acid from the drinking or tasting is slowly being remineralized by the saliva.
Okay, and you could probably speed it up by just making sure you got, you know, you can build up saliva in your mouth and just sort of rush it around your teeth.
Yeah, I mean that absolutely is going to be beneficial because you'll be turning that saliva over, getting fresh saliva in there, and getting new saliva in contact with the surface.
What about eating something afterwards? Because eating stimulates the saliva, and I suppose you could eat some of this mineralized chewing gum afterwards as well.
I think, Chris, the only other thing I'd like to mention is I talked about those, you know, protective and mineralizing agents for the tooth surface being the gum, and there is one product that I think is proving to be really beneficial, and it's a product called Tooth Mousse.
Tooth mousse, yeah.
It's made by a company called GC, and it's like a very thick toothpaste that's really rich in these, you know, in these mineral lines. It's made just for teeth,
yep.
Some people it's used a lot for tooth sensitivity, but also for helping people who are, you know, who are at risk of the surface demineralization and erosion of the teeth, and in some extreme cases with patients of mine who are having a lot of trouble from wine tasting and wine making, I actually make them a very small thin mouth guard, if you like.
Oh, yeah, like the ones you use when you're bleaching your teeth.
Exactly the same as the tooth whitening ones. Yeah, you're quite right. And they actually, you know, apply this in here, seat it over the teeth, and leave it in for an hour. In some cases, maximum benefit overnight. And some of these people have been having, you know, a great reduction in tooth damage by doing this for several days prior to, you know, a wine conference or a wine tasting event, or during, you know, the severe parts of their winemaking season, and obviously, you know, those evenings too, and for a few days afterwards, and it seems to be negating a lot of the damage.
All right, so you get a tooth plate, you build up the enamel, and you build up the minerals in the teeth. They get hammered while you're doing your tastings or whatever, and then eat some chewing gum on the way home, and then maybe put your mouth guard in, and you're away.
Absolutely, look, it's going to help. Yeah, it's going to make a big difference.
Okay. And probably, is there anything else?
Yeah, probably because the last thing to touch on is you know, in terms of protective coatings for the teeth, you know, that can be applied in a dental setting. And there's certainly a lot of work being done at the moment with various types of materials to actually bond permanent protective coatings onto the teeth. So almost like, in simple terms, you could think of it as almost like a special acid resistant tooth varnish, if you like.
Yeah.
And I've been doing some work here with some people who do a lot of wine making, wine tasting, even, you know, international wine judging, really giving their teeth a good hammering. And the initial results with that are looking really good.
So it's a varnish. It's like a painted on.
It's like a clear resin that slightly impregnates the surface of the tooth and also provides a surface coating. And so obviously, you know, being a resin, it should be careful here because there are other things called varnishes that we use in different situations on teeth, but I was just trying to give people the idea that it protects the teeth, you know, in the same way that a varnish provides an impervious coating on a piece of timber or something
yep.
like that.
Yep.
But, you know, these are clear reasons that set in place.
And how long do they last?
I at the moment, Chris, with people who are high users or high abusers of teeth with their vigorous wine tasting schedules, I've been finding that often I'll need to apply them once a year.
Okay.
But it's a very easy and sort of inexpensive thing to do when compared to the, you know, the long term damage and having to pay to fix and restore the teeth down the track when they.
Okay, once a year is not too bad. So just before the start of the tasting season in December, January,
Absolutely, that's usually we give them a good polish and apply another coating.
Does that stop the remineralization of the teeth because it's getting in the way of that?
It certainly does. Okay, yeah, you're quite right. That's the downside. So we make sure that that's why, as you say, it's good to do it at the time of the year. As you mentioned, when the teeth haven't been having a hammering, you know, and they've just been subjected to normal day-to-day life, and always make sure the teeth are in a well-mineralized state before we begin and then put this protective coating on.
All right then, James, that's really, really useful. Thank you very much.
No problem. Thank you, Chris.
Cheers.
I hope you enjoyed that interview. I know a lot of you guys must be thinking what bonkers I am talking to a dentist on a wine show. But I found it really interesting, especially the Dracula teeth bit. I get a lot of people asking me about the staining on their teeth, and I didn't really know the answer. And now I know. It's the saliva. You got sticky saliva. He did recommend a chewing gum after tasting, which remineralized the teeth. And I tried finding the gum. It goes by the name of Recaltant. And it's easy to find. I found it easiest by searching for the tooth mousse that he recommended as well. That's also by the same brand name, Recaltant. So if you're worried about your teeth, you got sensitive teeth, or you're worried that you just drink too much acidic wine, and that Sauvignon Blanc as well is pretty acidic, then maybe you want to look at those two products. Next week, we're off to some wine regions, and we're going to starting off by going to a Queensland wine region. You may recall we went to the Granite Bout a long time ago. Well, the second major wine region in Queensland is South Barnett. And it's a small wine region, but it's got some interesting solutions to the problems it has with climate, and that the grapes tend to want to have two crops during the year. So we'll have a listen to that and find out a bit about South Barnett and how they deal with some crazy temperatures up there. After that, we're going to do some wine regions in New Zealand, Martinborough and Whiteborough, and just north of Christchurch. But let's finish up with our mystery person. It was, of course, Robert Mondavi. He trailblazed the American industry before sailing up to Constellation. Right, that pretty much ends the show. We've got one last thing, is the quote, and I've changed the quote just at the last minute. This time the quote is by Lord Byron. He's a famous English poet, and his quote was talking about champagne bubbles, since we were talking about champagne glasses earlier. He described champagne as foaming whirls as white as Cleopatra's pearls. Nice, we rhyme. Until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Chris Scott and the news is read by Jane Scott. To listen to other shows, visit ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.